The National Weather Service issued a winter storm warning until noon for parts of central, northeast, and most of southern Wisconsin. The winter storm warning is in effect for all of southeast Wisconsin, with the exception of Racine and Kenosha. We're looking at this storm on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What is it like where you are? Do you work outdoors? How has the snow affected you getting your job done? Call in at 800-642-1234. Shoot an email to us at ideas@wpr.org. Jordan Girth is an associate researcher at the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies here at the UW-Madison. Jordan, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning to you.
So now this storm is moving out of Wisconsin today. It's known as Winter Storm Indra, is that right?
Yeah, that's how the Weather Channel has named it.
So it was expected to dump anywhere from 4 to 12 inches, depending on the part of the state it was in. How does this storm compare? How does this system compare to what we saw last week?
This is a slightly different type of system, but in terms of the snowfall that we've seen accumulating so far, the numbers are about on par with each other. Of course, this snow is still falling, so we're expecting several more inches through the morning hours if you're in southern Wisconsin.
And projected snow totals were pretty wide. They were all over the place for the system. What goes into determining how much precipitation may happen?
Well, snowfall is actually one of the hardest things that meteorologists have to predict. They first have to get the amount of liquid equivalent, if you will, correct. So they first have to figure out how much water content is in the cloud, and then they have to figure out how that water converts to snow. And in cases like this, where we have cold air to the north and modestly warm air to the south, you have less water content in that cooler air. And so you have to figure out exactly how that water converts to actual snow on the ground.
And how does a lake effect contribute to snow totals?
The lake effect adds to snow totals. We've had a warm winter so far, so a lot of the Great Lakes have not had an opportunity to cool down sufficiently. So there's a big difference in temperature between Lake Michigan and Lake Superior in this cold air mass that's really coming down for the first time. And so if the winds are right off the lake, and in many cases for Milwaukee, they have to be a northeasterly wind. For the northern Wisconsin areas, they have to be a northwesterly wind, which is a bit more common. You can get quite a bit of snow that's added as a result of the moisture, water vapor that comes off Lake Michigan and then is deposited on land with that wind.
So this cold air mass that's moving in, help us understand where it's coming from and when it will arrive in Wisconsin.
Well, it's already here. It's been a bit abated recently because of this weather system. But, this is a weather system air mass that originates from the Arctic, and over time, in the northern hemisphere during the winter months, that the stability, if you will, of that mass of cold air around the North Pole starts to get disturbed. And as it starts to get disturbed, it breaks apart, and pieces of it come down southward across the northern hemisphere continent. So, we're part of a global system here. We've got Europe, Asia, and North America. For the good part of December into early January, we didn't see the cold air funneling into North America, particularly Eastern North America, like it had been in Asia. Now things have changed as these pieces of the polar vortex, if you will, have started to move around the hemisphere, and now it's our turn to see some below normal temperatures for the remainder of the month of January.
Talking with Jordan Gerth, he's an associate researcher at UW-Madison's Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And you can join in with your weather questions, 800-642-1234. How has this snowstorm impacted you? Do you work outdoors? How has the snow affected you getting your job done? Are you worried about the chilly Arctic air, chilly temperatures in the forecast for ahead, and your safety? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Jordan, you talk about the polar vortex. What is the polar vortex? And we've also heard that it's getting more wobbly.
Right, exactly. And the polar vortex is really just a mass of cold air that sits over the North Pole. When it gets wobbly, it gets displaced, or it splits into fragments on its edges, and then those fragments make it down into the mid-latitudes, for example, where we are here in Wisconsin. So we're in that part of winter where the polar vortex has gotten fragmented into pieces, and we've seen those pieces move over the different continents. One of them now is here over eastern North America, and that is resulting and will continue to result in some cold air through the balance of the month of January.
As you look at numbers in terms of temperature and snowfall, how is this winter stacking up compared to other winters?
Well, this winter has started out very warm. Most people in Wisconsin have seen temperatures probably about 5 to 7 degrees above where they normally would have been. Now, in the past couple days, that's starting to change. But, in the climate world, we look at December, January, and February as really our coldest months, not really the traditional way that some people look at winter starting on in late December and continuing through late March. But we look at these three coldest months, and so far December was above normal. The first half of January was certainly above normal. Now we'll see a period of below normal temperatures that will somewhat balance out January, but then we'll take a look at February, and we don't see right now this very cold air mass continuing into February, but instead most likely a bit of a moderation.
Let's bring in a question here. Tracy is joining us from Milwaukee. Go ahead, Tracy.
Good morning. I was just wondering about what I've been noticing, that we get a big storm of snow, and then right after, it'll go right down into the really cold temperatures, and I feel like that's unusual, or I haven't noticed that in years previous. Is that something new, or is that typically always what happens?
So snow dump followed by frigid air, Jordan.
Yeah, I'm not sure if that's something that's new, but, it certainly depends on the year as to how frequently that happens. Oftentimes, as a weather system passes and dumps a significant amount of snow, it really makes it hard to keep the temperatures up. And so that new, fresh snowpack really lowers the temperatures. Now, it is also the case that behind weather systems, like the one we have in now, as that weather system departs, the winds come out of the north, and they really help reinforce some of the colder air that was already in place. So you have those two different things going on the backside of a weather system that's dumped some fresh snow that really help to bring temperatures down behind a fresh snow. And it's a good observation, particularly if you're living in southeastern Wisconsin. That effect can be limited a little bit by a warmer Lake Michigan that can sometimes keep temperatures up.
Jordan Gerth stays with us as we dig into what we need to know about the frigid temperatures in the forecast here in the Midwest. He's an associate researcher at UW-Madison's Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see when you look outside? Did you get a big dump of snow? Let's talk about it. We'll pick up the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. We're talking about the winter storm and the deep freeze here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin emergency management officials have tips on how to stay prepared for the snow and cold. If you must travel, allow plenty of extra time for your trip. Keep at least a half tank of gas in your car. Check the roads before you leave home through 511 Wisconsin, the DOT's up-to-the-minute traffic information system. What are conditions like where you are? How is it affecting your morning commute? Are you concerned about the deep freeze in the days ahead and your safety? Join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Jordan Girth stays with us. He's an associate researcher at UW-Madison's Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. And let's go back to the phones now with Jeff joining us from Grand Marsh. Hi, Jeff. What's the question?
Good morning.
Morning.
Not really to do with this particular storm, but a couple days ago on the Weather Channel, I seen them showing how high and low pressure affects the jet stream. And I'm curious, how do you know, let's say there's everything is just even keel right now, how do you know that there's high pressure coming out of Mexico and that it's going to reach all the way up here to the upper Midwest?
Jordan, how do you know through your modeling?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we have a lot of different weather stations out there, and we also have some basic tenets for how we know the air likes to move. For example, it likes to move from high pressure to low pressure, and as the caller said, the weather really strives to be in an equal state, right? It doesn't like to deviate too far, but with the differential heating, with the changes in the seasons and the amount of sunlight coming in, the weather never really gets the opportunity, the atmosphere never really gets the opportunity to completely settle down. And so we see these shifts from very high pressure to very low pressure. So what we do when we take in all of these observations, not only from the ground stations, but also from weather satellites, is that we use those assumptions that we know about the atmosphere, and we are able to use kind of complex mathematics to move these weather systems forward in time. And so we, based on how it is now, we can make some assumptions and generally predict it forward in time. Of course, weather predictions aren't accurate. That's why, you know, there's still a little bit to learn as far as the accuracy of the observations and some of the assumptions we make about the atmosphere. So hope that answers the question. That's a really good one. And in wintertime, we do see a lot of changes in the pressure. Part of that is due to the polar vortex.
Let's bring in Willie now from Steuben. Willie, hi.
Hey, how's it going? I saw this really weird thing the other day. I'm old, 52, and I never saw this. I've lived in Wisconsin all my life. And these snowflakes, I guess, I call them snowflakes, they fell out of the sky, and they were shaped like hair. Like hair on my head. I'm not kidding you.
So kind of stringy snowflakes. Jordan?
Yeah, snowflake creation is an interesting one. Oftentimes, when you see those kind of flakes, that's an indication that that snow was formed in a very cold atmosphere. I would assume that day was probably one of the cooler days we've had so far this year. Generally, as you get closer to 32 degrees, the snowflakes take a more traditional shape, you know, the star shape of the flakes. And as you get into colder temperatures, they tend to become more elongated. Now, as far as like hair, that's pretty long. I'm not sure I've ever seen anything like that myself, but, it is possible that you get more, cylindrical shaped snowflakes as you get to those colder temperatures.
We have an email here from Ruth who says, what snowstorm? The Spooner Hayward area keeps getting missed. Why do some areas get pounded with snow repeatedly and some areas get missed completely?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not sure there's necessarily a good answer to that. Winter snowfall overall really comes down to two or three big events. So far, it has been southern Wisconsin that's been the big recipient of those snows. And yeah, if you're north of a Green Bay to La Crosse line or so this morning, you're probably not seeing very much in terms of snow at all. There is a big snow deficit in the Eau Claire area heading up into the Northwoods. It's just how this winter's played out. It may not continue like that. There may be opportunities for snow in northern central Wisconsin, but as of right now, the way the weather systems have come out of the plains, it's been southern Wisconsin that's been the beneficiary.
Let's talk about wind chill for a moment. We know dangerous wind chills are coming. Help us understand what is wind chill first.
Yeah, wind chill is a complex formula that really takes into account the air temperature and the wind speed. And pretty much why we use the wind chill is because if you're outside, particularly uncovered skin, the likelihood that you're going to suffer from hypothermia or start feeling the effects of that cold air is greater as the winds increase, because it's really the wind that extracts the heat away from your body. So you could be out on a very calm night, the temperatures may be only in the single digits, and you may not feel that it's all that cold. But you start adding just 5 miles per hour of wind to that, and it feels a lot colder, and that's because the wind is really taking the heat away from your body, and that wind chill really describes the temperature that your body is feeling as the wind is kind of taking the heat away from it.
In this Arctic air blast we'll be getting, what will wind chills be like?
It's going to depend on where you are, but certainly we could see, particularly this weekend, wind chills down in the minus 20, minus 30 range. Air temperatures already are going to be fairly chilly as we struggle to reach the single digits above zero here, at least in the southern part of the state, Friday, Saturday. So you start to add the wind on top of that, and, yeah, you're going to be in the double digits below zero. Hopefully people in Wisconsin know how to bundle up, so time to get good use of those hats, mittens, and very warm coats.
So given the long-range forecasts, can Wisconsinites expect to get a warm-up anytime soon as we look into the coming weeks? I know that's tricky when you look at your predictions and your complex math.
That's right. It is tricky, and it is it's a forecast. It may not prove 100% accurate. I will say that I think that the coldest 2 weeks of the winter appear to be here through about February 1st or so. As everybody knows, on February 2nd, the groundhog is going to have a say, and we'll have to wait to see what the groundhog says. But anyway, I'm kidding about that. The after about February 1st or so, we start to see a change, a moderation of temperatures back into, slightly more normal, the normal range, which is probably in the upper 20s to lower 30s. Some indications show that by later in the month, it could actually be even slightly warmer than that. So this cold air does not appear like it's going to be staying around for many, many weeks. And then as we head into the spring, hopefully that warming trend will continue. I know a lot of people have perhaps negative memories of last winter getting perhaps one of the largest snowstorms in Wisconsin's history in mid-April. I can't rule that out completely, but I could say it's a good chance that that's not going to happen again this year. So for Wisconsin growers, I think it's going to be a more natural progression to spring.
Jordan, we've learned to let go. We don't recall. No, absolutely no recollection.
Okay, that's good.
So what do you love about studying weather? What makes meteorology so fascinating to you?
I've loved studying the weather ever since I was a young child. It's one of those things that you continue to see new things every day, and there's a lot of technology involved in sensing the atmosphere, and it's always a bit humbling to do forecasts and to some extent be right or be wrong. And you know, we're getting to a state in the science now where we're actually right more than we are wrong, contrary to what some people say. And I think that's been a great contribution to see that in my career and be part of that with all of the technology that we have, weather satellites here at the University of Wisconsin, and really put those into play to make forecasts and weather warnings better for the public.
Well, Jordan, thank you for joining us. Stay warm.
You too.
Jordan Girth is an associate researcher at UW-Madison's Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Keep sharing your weather photos, your experiences on Twitter by mentioning WPR Mornings. Up next, it's news. Then the Detroit Auto Show is underway in the Motor City, offering car buyers a sneak peek at what we might see in the coming year. An auto industry expert joins us to break down the highs and lows from the showroom floor, as well as the overall trends we're seeing in the auto industry. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. The Detroit Auto Show is underway, and in the depths of winter, we're talking about what car makers have in store here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We got a look at the 2020 Ford Explorer. Volkswagen showed off its updated facade, but mainstay brands from previous shows were no-shows, including Mercedes, BMW, and Audi. Are you in the market for a new car this year? What's catching your eye? What features are important to you? Do shows like the Detroit Auto Show still carry the same excitement that they used to? Join in with your questions, your observations, 800-642-1234. Email them our way to ideas@wpr.org. Todd Lassa is the Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine. Todd, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. Good morning.
Well, so before we take a look at all of the cars on the floor, what can you give us a general sense of how the auto industry is doing here in the U.S.?
Well, the auto industry has come off a couple of record years, about 17.5 million sales per year, which is a very good number, as I'd say, a record. But when you look historically at the population of the U.S., you know, not as high as it has been as a percentage, say, in the 70s or 80s or even a couple of years in the last decade. But very strong years and several in a row. So you've sold a lot of new cars in the last 4 or 5 years. It's it has peaked. It will have to it will be coming down a bit from about 17.3 million this year. The record was 17.5 a couple of years ago, and 17.3 million in 2018. I think we're expecting about 16.8 or 16.9 this year. So when you look at something like General Motors' announcement late last year that it would be shutting down some factories and discontinuing some car lines, they are still over capacity in the U.S., and as is Ford to a certain extent, but very much GM. And so these car companies will have to cut down on production a bit.
Yeah, so we're seeing some leveling off in the marketplace. It's always interesting, too, how gas prices influence a bit the car buying trends and what these automakers are putting out.
Yes, they do. Certainly pickup trucks are very popular, and they have been for several years now. They're always automakers are kind of crowing about how models like the Ford F-150 or the Ram 1500 used to be called Dodge Ram. Now it's just Ram as the brand. Chevrolet, Silverado, and so on. They're selling them as luxury vehicles. A lot of them sell for prices in the mid-40s to mid-50s. So that's where I think the low fuel prices come into play. A lot of mainstream press talk about how the SUVs have picked up, and that combined cars and SUVs make up for something like 70% of or more of the industry. But when you talk about those sports utility vehicles, the ones we're buying now tend to be smaller car-based sport utility vehicles, whereas 12 or 14 years ago they would be truck-based SUVs. And so these smaller car-based SUVs are getting fuel mileage that, especially if you go with front-wheel drive instead of all-wheel drive, will get pretty close to the same fuel mileage as, say, a midsize sedan.
So what is going on with Ford and Volkswagen? We saw the Explorer on the show floor. Volkswagen has an updated Passat, two very different car companies. How are they doing?
Oh, well, Ford has been languishing on the stock market lately, which is not good. And they've also been very dependent on their full-size pickup truck, which is something that sells well in North America, but not very well in Europe, where Ford still has a kind of a big presence. And I think that's why you're seeing this kind of connection between this alliance between Volkswagen and Ford Motor Company, which aren't as different as you might think, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But the beginning of this alliance will be to build commercial vehicles, pickup trucks and vans for each other, with Volkswagen using its extra capacity in Europe, for example, and Ford, you know, in other parts of the world, Africa, South Africa, that is, South America and other parts of the world, Asia. And eventually, although they say they have no plans yet for Ford to build vehicles for VW in the United States or in North America, I think that will happen before long. So both have been hurting a bit. Both are similar in that the Ford family has about 40% of Ford stock, but they have a special Class B stock that gives them a controlling interest. And Volkswagen in Germany has a major shareholder, the government of Lower Saxony. So in a way, they're not all that different.
So is Volkswagen over its emission scandal? Has it moved on?
Yeah, oh boy, that's a great question. I think actually it's probably lingering in Europe more than it is in the United States these days. But in the United States, the problem is that its best sales year, Volkswagen of America, its best sales year stands at calendar year 1970. So after the diesel scandal, they pulled a lot of cars from inventory. They bought back diesels and so on. And they sell less than 400,000 cars a year in the United States. They've been kind of languishing in, as far as sales for several years. They've been catching up with sport utility vehicles. The new Volkswagen Atlas is designed to compete against the Ford Explorer, for example, which is the best seller in that segment, and as a three-row kind of family SUV. So Volkswagen's still playing catch-up. With this new updated Passat, it's looking to kind of grab some of the business that is being given up by car companies that are saying they're not going to build sedans anymore. But it's nothing like blockbuster sales with or without that scandal. I think they'd be more or less in the same spot.
Todd Lassa is with us. He's the Detroit bureau chief for Automobile Magazine. You have a line at 800-642-1234. Are you in the market for a new car this year? Truck, SUV? What's catching your eye from the Detroit Auto Show? What features do you see that are really appealing on new cars these days? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Todd, you're talking three-row vehicles. Kia is out there at the show with a Telluride model, which is a three-row vehicle. Can you tell us about that?
Well, that's a very it's a large three-row vehicle. Again, it's kind of a family SUV. It's got a little bit of a blockier design, say a little bit sharper edged or boxy, if you will, than some of the competition. And that does two things. First of all, kind of a boxier body will give you more interior space, so that third row maybe isn't so cramped for just your kids or your teenagers. And secondly, it gives it a little more of a trucky look, so it looks like a serious off-road SUV. They named it to Telluride for a reason, to evoke the type of vehicle you would take to go skiing in Telluride, Colorado. This is also in a segment where Kia has been a little bit behind the competition and has not kind of kept up with the move toward SUVs. And as a result, last year, for example, Subaru outsold Kia in the United States, which was quite a move. Kia is doing some pretty good stuff. They've got some interesting cars and SUVs, and their catching up is going pretty well. This is a V6-powered sports utility vehicle. So, again, it won't be a gas guzzler by any means, but being a three-row SUV, a few mileage, it will be kind of average.
So when you see a new model come out like the Telluride, I know back in the day I had the first-year model of the Toyota Matrix. Should we as consumers hold back and let that first model year run its course, let all the kinks get out of their system, or should we just dive right in and try a brand new model?
Boy, that's the age-old question for buying automobiles. You know, and a lot of people like to get that first-year model because, you know, the first on the block, people who maybe care a little bit more about cars and SUVs and want to, you know, have the latest thing. I think they're way better than they were years ago, even a decade ago, and probably certainly 40 or 50 years ago. Pardon me. You know, if you look at some of the quality indexes like J.D. Power and so on, yes, generally when you have a brand that introduces several new models in a given model year, its score goes down. But what they're scoring a lot of these days has a lot to do with, say, some of the latest infotainment systems. I hate the word infotainment, but that's what they call them. The thing in the center of your dash that plays the radio, the heater, air conditioner, probably gives you Wi-Fi these days. Maybe Apple CarPlay or Android for auto.
Maybe caffeine maybe for your system or something. I mean, I'm sure it can do all those things.
if only, you know. I mean, you can. There are some vehicles, I think, with heated cup holders. So at least you can put your coffee in that cup holder.
Well, you know, your publication, Automobile Magazine, takes a close look at the show's hits and misses. First of all, what's getting you excited?
You know, we're car guys, we're car people, and the first thing that got us excited, I think, was when, at the beginning of the show, that is the beginning of the press day, which was last week, Monday, one of the first big introductions was the new Toyota Supra, and Akio Toyota, who is the scion of the company that uses his family's name, came out to introduce it from Japan. They brought some journalists in from Japan as well as Europe. They brought in Fernando Alonso, a Formula One champion, who has driven Toyotas in the 24 hours of Le Mans, and introduced this car. And this is, you know, a tight, small sports car. It has a lot of BMW running gear, including a BMW engine and BMW basically the basic platform. But it is, to me, still far more exciting than any SUV you could possibly wheel out.
We're talking about the Detroit Auto Show with Todd Lassa. He is the Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What auto trends do you see coming down the pike that pique your interest? Let's talk about it. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Detroit Auto Show has been around in some way, shape, or form since 1907. There was a break during World War II, but this year marks the 30th anniversary of the show's international focus, and it's the last year for the January show as it moves to a June date. We're talking cars, and you have a line at 800-642-1234. Have you been to the Detroit Auto Show? What do you love about car shows? Are they helpful in thinking about where cars are going in the future and what features you might be interested in? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Todd Lassa is our guide. He is the Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine. Todd, you must just love January, but now you're going to have to really love June because I understand this show is moving to summer.
It is moving to summer, beginning of June, and this has been kind of a long time coming. This show has bumped up against the CES, the Consumer Electronics Show, as it used to be known, in Las Vegas, just a week or so before the press days of the auto show. And a lot of automakers are concentrating on CES. Mercedes, which did not appear at the Detroit Auto Show this year for the first time in a long, long time, instead introduced a car, the new CLA class, at CES in Las Vegas. I don't think they got any better of a bump of media attention outside of automotive media at CES than they would have gotten at the North American International Auto Show. That said, I think the summertime period is going to be a little bit tougher to get some new and concept cars into the Detroit show.
Let's go to Ann now, joining us from Green Bay. Hi, Ann.
Hello. Well, you've talked a lot about trucks and SUVs, but I'm just wondering what the status of the minivans are, because those are so popular.
Yeah, in minivan in our fam. What do we know, Todd?
Well, the minivans are kind of stagnant. I think Chrysler has revived that segment a bit with the latest Pacifica, which has been out a couple of years. In fact, we just had an announcement that I think it was yesterday that Waymo is going to be constructing a factory here in the southeast Michigan area to build self-driving cars. And, of course, they're testing Chrysler Pacificas that are level 4, level 5 autonomy in Arizona right now. And so that's the future, is that, you know, maybe a minivan that will drive itself. That segment, though, has been kind of, you know, a few brands, Toyota, Honda, Chrysler, have done fairly well, but not the other brands. The sports utilities are kind of overwhelming it.
Yeah, Volkswagen washed its hands completely of the minivan.
And the last one they did was a joint venture with Chrysler, so that just didn't work very well for them. But sports utilities is where it's at. I should mention, though, one of the car of interest is the Nissan IMS concept shown at the Detroit show, and one of the few concepts still that appeared at this particular show. A few years ago, you have a lot of many more concepts here, and I think that may be making a difference. But anyway, the car looks like it could be a next-generation Nissan Maxima, but it's a little bit taller. It's about the same size as a Nissan Maxima, except it's what they call crossover utility vehicle height, about 59 inches tall instead of, say, 55, 56 inches. And the idea is that you step directly into the car, rather step down into it or step up into it. And, you know, it'd probably make a great Uber car. It's designed to be all electric with a 380 miles range and full autonomy, or you can drive it yourself if you want.
Well,
that's just a concept.
Yeah, that's a concept. Let's look at alternative fuel vehicles, more specifically electric cars. What kind of commitment are we seeing from automakers when it comes to electric vehicles?
You're actually seeing a pretty big commitment, considering that the Trump administration has said it's going to be pulling back on the 54.5 MPG CAFE standard by 2025, which obviously, if you sell a certain number of electric cars, will take care of part of that. The current market in the U.S. is something like 1.5% of the market consists of electric cars, and that would be mostly Tesla, the Chevrolet Bolt, the Nissan Leaf, and not much more. And GM has plans for, I think it's 20 or 23 electric vehicles in the next 3 or 4 years. Ford has a smaller but similar commitment, and Volkswagen, for example, which may be the next step in the relationship between Ford and VW to bring more electric vehicles to market, including one that will be kind of that retro VW van from the 1960s, the microbus.
Oh, wow.
Kind of replacing the Beetle in the VW lineup, but in this case it will be fully electric.
That perks some ears up. Let's go to Tom now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Tom.
Hi, yes. Three cheers for the minivan. I have two Dodge Caravans. One I got a 258,000 miles out of without a single breakdown, and I'm currently driving another one with 119,000 miles. It's fantastic. Anything about hybrid vans?
Thanks,
about
Tom.
Hybrid vans.
Yeah.
Well, again, there was nothing really new with minivans at this show. However, the Chrysler Pacifica plug-in hybrid is selling, and you know, if you're ready to trade in that 197,000 mile van for one of those, the price on it with you get one of those tax rebates can be not much more than buying a gasoline powered version of the van. So the plug-in hybrid, you plug it in. That means that you can run on pure electric for a certain number of miles. Obviously, being a bigger, heavier van rather than a small car, the mileage on pure electric is not as good, but and then when you run out of the electric charge, you still have the gasoline engine. So it's that kind of hybrid.
Yeah, Tom, thanks. Keep on trucking with those caravans. Let's go to Randy now in Ripon. Hi, Randy.
Hi, good morning. I just one thing that I find very frustrating with the whole electric vehicle. Don't get me wrong, I'm not against them, but nobody ever brings up this fact that and us in the northern climes require heat and defrosters. And everybody that has one, when I ask them what happens when they turn the heat on, their range gets almost cut in half. And to generate heat from electricity is hugely inefficient.
Randy, because we're running short on time, I want to get Todd to really answer this. What about heat and defrosters and power?
Yes. Well, actually, my wife would tell you that that's a problem with electric cars, too. So she's not crazy about them from that point of view. But, yes, when you talk about range, whether it's a Tesla or a Chevrolet Bolt or Nissan Leaf, that range, of course, is dependent on what other electrically driven accessories you use. And because you don't have a gasoline engine to get warm and you basically draw the heat from that engine in a conventional car, the electric vehicles don't get that warm to begin with. So, you know, I think that's something that they're trying to solve with electric heated seats and electric heated steering wheels and other devices. You can pre-warm your car before you unplug it from your driveway or your garage, and that will help. But the caller has a point that that you certainly lose range as a result.
Very quickly, before we have to let you go, how far away are we on driverless cars?
Oh, that's another million-dollar question right there, $1 billion, I guess it would be these days. I think we have a lot of the technology. We are very close. We have to do a lot more testing. There's been some resistance to it lately, in fact, in Arizona, where Waymo is testing those Chrysler Pacific minivans that are self-driving minivans. They've had some residents throw rocks at the vehicles recently. So I think we're going to see a level four within 5 years, where you'll have it'll be similar to Cadillac Super Cruise, where you'll be able to take your car on the freeway, a boring part of I-94 or I-80 across the country or whatever, hit a button, and the car will steer and stay in its lane for you and use the adaptive cruise control, which has been around for a while, to slow down and speed up as traffic cuts in front of you.
We'll be watching for it. Todd, thanks so much for joining us.
Kate, thanks for having me.
Todd Lassa is the Detroit Bureau Chief for Automobile Magazine. Just ahead, we'll take a look at what Governor Tony Evers discussed in his first State of the State address. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.